Hi, my name is Ed Stetzer, and welcome to another edition of The Exchange. This is not actually a live edition, so you can't tweet your questions as we normally do, but you can engage in the chat room. We'll be in there, and you can dialogue with us, our team, as we talk about some of the issues we're discussing today on The Exchange. And the issue today is going to be the issue of leadership. In just a minute, I'm going to introduce my guest, who's an expert in the area of leadership. But I should say, I have a love-hate relationship with leadership. First of all, I hate it because I'm not a natural-born leader, never have been. And so I never really was able to step in. I meet people who sort of become these leaders because they've always been. I wasn't. I was a bookworm. I was a nerd. I was all those things in school. And so leadership for me was something that wasn't naturally inherited, but instead it was a skill and a practice I had to learn. And learn I did. And I think all of us can learn to be leaders. I think leadership is not something that simply we are born with, but we can learn skills, activities, and practices that help us in this area of leadership. The difficulty, I believe, is that leadership has sort of fallen on hard times in evangelical churches. I think part of that is a bit of a backlash to what I call the maxwellization of leadership in the last couple of decades. I remember when Mike Dodson and I were co-authoring Comeback Churches, we were doing the research, and maybe we caught up in that backlash a little bit, and we wanted to find what were the factors that led to church revitalization, and we wanted to find prayer. You know, we began with these hypotheses, prayer or a renewed focus on preaching, or all these things that were so essential that we believe in. And so we did this research, and we studied 320-plus churches, called them, and did multiple calls with dozens of them. And here's what we found. We found that everything rises and falls on leadership. We found that those other things were essential. We're so focused on in these churches, prayer and preaching and structure and evangelism and ministry. But what we found is that leaders led churches to engage in those areas. And by the way, though I was concerned about the maxwellization of leadership, the number one author that they credited and cited, and when we kind of drilled in with those who talked about a change of their leadership, was John Maxwell. And so what we find is this, is that we find right now the pendulum swings back and forth, right? Everything was leadership in the 80s and the 90s, and then the pendulum swings the other way, and we move away from leadership. We hear people say, we don't want to be CEO leaders, we don't want to be dictatorial leaders and hold things over people. But and then it goes back. What I would say is that we need to recognize that Scripture is unapologetic in holding up the value and the example of leadership throughout. And we need to get a picture that leadership matters. Leadership matters to God. God chooses and uses leaders. Leadership matters to churches. God uses leaders within churches to lead people to that which He desires them to engage. And so at the end of the day, I think for many of us, we need to get over this pendulum swing and to think more biblically and more discerningly about this issue of leadership. Now, again, are there extremes? Certainly. Again, I don't want to go the pendulum back the other way where everything was about leadership. Notice the phrase that I used, it's been widely quoted, everything rises and falls on leadership. Well, everything's not about leadership, but leadership impacts all of these other areas. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about leadership with an expert with a new book. His name is Jeff Orge. He's a friend of mine. I'm going to introduce him in just a moment. But before we do, we want you to watch this moment, this video, and then we'll come back and jump in to an important conversation we think the church needs to hear today about the importance of leadership.
Kids like to be wowed, and not just with games and toys. Bible Studies for Life combines creative teaching elements, biblical stories, and hands-on learning to wow kids with the God of the Bible. And to learn that the same God that you teach them about is the one who is bigger than all of the problems and decisions they face. Wow them with something that lasts.
Wow.
Esse quam videri.
Esse quam videri. To be.
To be rather than to see.
Rather than to see.
I'm good at appearance.
I'm good at appearance.
Good at.
Good at putting on the show.
Putting on the show of I know what I'm doing.
But I'm not convinced.
But I'm not convinced.
I want to know the answers to questions.
Questions I don't want to say out loud.
To know what the Bible means in my life. Today.
Today.
The way I act with friends.
The decisions I make.
Where the next steps.
Where next steps will take me.
Take me. Show me.
And we're back, and welcome to another edition of The Exchange. I'm joined today with my friend Jeff. Jeff Orridge is the president of Golden Gate Seminary. You have served there for many years. Prior to that, you were a judicatory leader over a region and led there in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
I'm actually headed to the Pacific Northwest very, very soon, so love what you've been involved with. But what I particularly have enjoyed is your writing on leadership.
Mm-hmm.
You've actually written several books on the subject. You've written on leadership, the painful side of leadership, the character of leadership. Is God calling me, which is a kind of a consideration of a call to pastoral leadership,
right.
And then two other books as well, The Case for Antioch and Live Like a Missionary. So great stuff, curriculum materials. People can find more information at jefforge.com. It's I-O-R-G, J-E-F-F-I-O-R-G. You must constantly have to spell your name.
I have many last names.
You do.
Yeah,
what's
really
the background of that?
My last name was actually invented at Ellis Island, New York by a customs officer who let our ancestor into the country who spoke no English and wrote his name down the best he could.
Really?
So there is no European name.
That's
that
fascinating. I was going to say, that's kind of an odd name. I-O-R-G, Jeff Orridge.
Yeah.
You can get more information about him at his site at jefforridge.com. You're also on Twitter at Jeff_Orridge as well, I-O-R-G. We're going to be talking about your book in particular in just a minute, but I want to talk generally about leadership for a bit. Your new book is The Seasons of a Leader's Life. It's available now.
Right.
And Seasons of a Leader's Life, Learning, Leading, and Leaving Your Legacy. But you've written a lot about it. And how has your understanding of leadership sort of changed? You've been a pastor. You've been kind of a judicatory district leader in a denomination. Now you're a seminary president. How has your understanding of leadership changed as your roles have changed along the way?
Well, I would say, first of all, it's matured.
Okay.
I've come to understand leadership is much more complex, perhaps, than I thought when I was much younger. And I put a lot more value today on working with people and the relational aspects of leadership than I did when I first started out in ministry. I was, in the beginning, very driven, very focused, and didn't always appreciate the dynamics of what it meant to work with people and to bring people along in a process of leadership. I think I'm a lot better at that now. Still pretty driven and focused, but I'm able to work with people and lead people to do things better than I was maybe 20 years ago.
You know, I work with a leader when I was at the North American Mission Board. A guy named was Nate Adams. You know,
mm-hmm.
Nate. And,
I do.
Nate always, to quote a movie, he always made me want to be a better man. He always
right.
sort of got into my stuff, helped me to think through things better. He's one of the best leaders I had worked for. And I wonder, how do you work with the faculty there at Golden Gate when you were what we call a state convention in our denominational family, but just in general, a judicatory district leader in the Northwest? How did you help? How do you now, and how did you along the way help others to become what God is calling them to do?
Well, I think what you mentioned about the lead person you worked for at North American Mission Board is significant, because when I wrote the book, The Character of Leadership, the premise of that book was that leadership is first of all about character formation. And so the first thing I work with people on is about how God is at work in them to change them and make them more like Jesus Christ. In fact, I use the phrase leadership laboratory to describe where God has placed you in leadership, that it's not primarily that God is working to get things done through you. That's actually slowing his work down.
Mm-hmm.
So he must be doing something else, and that is he's working in you to change you, to make you more like Jesus Christ. So I start with leaders at that point. We do that at the seminary. We do that in our curriculum. I do it with the people I supervise, so that a component of all we're working toward is not just what tasks are you getting accomplished, but how are you growing as a person, and how do you see God at work in your life to shape you into a better man or a better woman and into a better leader. So that's a really key foundation to what I do in terms of developing leaders.
Okay. Now, most of the people who are watching are pastors and church leaders. And so
mm-hmm.
if you're talking to a pastor or church leader, and you teach this all the time at the
right.
seminary and
mm-hmm.
seminars, conferences,
right.
I think last time I saw you, you were teaching this at Saddleback. I came into a room and there you
mm-hmm.
were, and so I stood in the back and distracted
right.
you on purpose.
Yes,
so,
you did.
So I did. You remember? So we had a little fun. But so what do you say to pastors about how they should be developing their leaders, their staff, men and women they're connected with in the priority of their day? I, I've often said that pastors tend to spend not enough time with two groups of people, and they begin with L's. It must be a pastor thing. You had L's in your subtitle, but they don't spend enough time with leaders, and they don't spend enough time with the lost. Mm-hmm. They're spending a lot of time with leaners sometimes, things of that sort. So how do you instruct the pastor of, you know, First Church, this is how you need to spend time and develop leaders?
It's interesting. I have a presentation, as you know, on leadership development in local churches. And those two groups that you just mentioned, I've never put it quite that way, but I will after today.
Yes, you're going to claim it as your own.
Because the first thing I teach pastors when I teach them on developing leaders is that leaders come from the community. Mm-hmm. They come out of the harvest. Right. They come out of the lost people around you. Mm-hmm. And so if you want more leaders in your church, the first thing to do is win more lost people to faith in Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Too many pastors think only in terms of developing leaders from the people who are sitting in front of mm-hmm. them on a Sunday, rather than developing leaders from the whole scope of people they're trying to reach in their community. And so really the solution to more of anything in church, more leaders, more money, more facilities, more anything, is find more lost people, win them to faith in Christ. So I start there. But then the second thing you said is spend more time with leaders. And really, pastors who have an intentionality about a long-term ministry in a location, or who see their ministry as having a longer shelf life than just their short time in the pastorate at that particular location, you say, well, I'm staying 20 years. Okay, that's still a short shelf life.
Right.
They really invest themselves in training others, not only to work with them, but to carry on the work after they're not part of it any longer. And I, as a pastor, I always tried to be working with a small group of men that I was training for leadership, and usually one person at a time that I was working with one-on-one. Mm-hmm. And you can't work with 20 people in that kind of way, but you can work with three or four, always shaping someone to be moving forward in leadership. Sometimes pastors don't want to do this because they find it inefficient, slow. They have failures, guys drop out, they don't mature, they don't fulfill the potential we thought they had. All of those things are true, but nonetheless, there will be some people that will progress out of that strategy and will turn into leaders that you need. So you have to get past all the excuses and just get busy shaping people to be leadership, to be leaders in your place.
So how much time would you say, maybe it's different by size of the church, mm-hmm. I don't know, but just for you, someone says to you, well, how much time should I spend and how practically should I do it? Am I meeting with five key leaders a week? You sort of mentioned a group of 20 and then one or two or three in a smaller group. Kind of not dissimilar to we hear about the disciples of 12 and then the three.
Right.
So give us some practical handles.
Well,
how should we do that?
I've talked to multiple pastors that to try to discover what they do, the ones that I consider good at leadership development. And here's the pattern that I discover. In some way, they meet with a small group of men and women that they're trying to move toward leadership in a group setting. And that can be anywhere from 3 to 15, 20 right. people. Mm-hmm. Usually it's a once a week meeting, maybe for an hour, maybe breakfast, something like that. It's a select group where pastors call those people together for a semester or for maybe a school year. Mm-hmm. And they say, we're going to meet together every Friday morning from 6:30 to 7:45. We're going to have breakfast and I'm going to teach you about leadership, share with you what I've learned about leadership, challenge you to take on leadership roles in our church. And then out of that group, people emerge and can be directed into the various needs that are there because people do have varying levels of leadership capacity.
Right, sure.
So you're going to develop and direct as you move along. But then I did this as a pastor and effective pastors also out of that group try to work with one, no more than two, key people at a time, one-on-one, mentoring them toward the most significant leadership roles in your church or your organization. So, for example, out of that group of 10 or 12 that you might be meeting with, you select the one that you think has the potential to be an elder or an associate pastor or a staff leader or a program developer in your church, and you meet with that person really intentionally, maybe not for 6 months or a year, but maybe for at least 3 months or so to really focus their training on what you want them to move toward.
That's good.
I did that and look back over the men I worked with, some of which became very significant leaders, some frankly didn't.
Right.
But nonetheless, I had to keep at the process continually if I was going to produce the leaders I needed.
That's good. When you talk to pastors and staff members, one of the questions they often have is, should we hire from outside and bring in leadership, or should we develop leadership from inside? What's your recommendation? Because you're also a seminary president, mm-hmm. so you're actually training leaders that go to churches, but at the same time, you talk about raising up leaders from the harvest, mm-hmm. not the term you use, but the idea of
right.
finding lost people, raising them up. What about staff?
The answer to your question is yes.
Yes.
But here's the, and I've done both as a pastor and as a denominational leader and seminary president, where I brought people from within our organization or within our denomination, but also brought people occasionally in from the outside. Mm-hmm. So the advantage of bringing up someone within your organization is that you know them, you know their character, you know their weaknesses, and you're willing to work with those weaknesses and to and you see them moving into leadership in that particular setting or venue. The disadvantage of bringing people up within your organization is they typically have a limited view of just doing ministry in that place, mm-hmm. especially if it's a lay person who's emerging in leadership and the ministry grows so large that now you need someone to be paid or someone. They only have that one-dimensional viewpoint. Bringing in some from the outside, you trade off some of those strengths. You don't know all about their character. You don't fully understand their weaknesses. But what you do get is a much broader perspective and someone who has a leadership and decision-making base and an experience base where they can draw on ideas to make your organization better. I think you need a balance. I talked with one megachurch executive pastor who put it this way to me, and he was a very strong supporter of our school. And so I wondered how he balanced these things. And here's what he said. If we believe a person is only going to have a ministry in our church, we want to raise them up within our church and place them here and keep them here for a lifetime. If we see a person that we think is going to have a much broader ministry than just our local congregation, either as a part of our team going out on mission or church planting, or maybe larger than what we're going to do, or we need someone who has a perspective larger than ours, we always look outside our organization. Mm. So he found the balance just even within their church, and I've tried to follow that model. At the seminary even. I usually look inside first and then try to raise people up to certain levels of responsibility. But oftentimes when it's a person that I know I need a global perspective, I'll go outside to bring in some help.
Interesting. One of the things that I find both fascinating and disturbing at the same time is you've said now twice, I want to know their weaknesses. And mm-hmm. you talked before also about character. There's a great level of trust that right. I think is required. I'm guessing a lot of people watching this are saying, well, you know, I don't have that level of trust. I don't have that level of trust with the pastor. And mm-hmm. and we all can think of bad examples of pastors. Well, this pastor's right. all about themselves, you know. And so in the midst of all that, it requires you as a leader or me as a pastor to say, not only am I going to know your strengths and weaknesses, not only going to know your weaknesses and your struggles, I'm not going to use them against you,
right.
but I'm for you.
Right.
So how do you develop and engender that kind of trust and that kind of leadership relationship?
Well, I think it starts with a leader setting an example of security and transparency mm-hmm. with the people he works with or the people she works with. Mm-hmm. Some leaders are far too guarded, far too protective, and make the agenda of the organization far too much about them. Mm-hmm. So I think it starts with a leader saying, I have a transparency about who I am and about my life, and that includes having enough security to admit that I have weaknesses and that those weaknesses need to be compensated for by organizational mm-hmm. strength. Once you admit that yourself, then it breaks down barriers and allows people around you to feel the same way about who they are and to understand that weakness does not equal disqualification from ministry.
Wow.
And when I'm employing someone that's going to work directly with me, I make a very thorough investigation of their abilities and their training and their expertise. But we then bring them out to the seminary for about 3 days of final interviewing. And during that 3 days, we make sure that we spend time out to dinner. We spend time with their family and with some of our families. And I also make sure they spend time with the entire team of people they're going to be working with. To pass what I call the desert island test. And that is, if I'm marooned on a deserted island with this person, will I enjoy myself until we're rescued? And if not, we don't want that person sure. because we recognize there's not that transparency and that security and that yeah. humility that they're able to relax and be themselves with us. And if they're guarded or in some way resistant, we know we're really not going to be able to work together over the long haul.
Transparency, security, and honesty.
Right.
And those are big issues. When we live in a culture that's right. very much don't have those things, you know, be the pastor or the leader or the denominational leader or the executive is untouchable. Is often surrounded by people that cannot speak truth into this situation. And I've written some about this in a series I did called On Unhealthy Christian Organizations. What you're describing is the kind of healthy Christian organization mm-hmm. that I want, and I see at Golden Gate, and I see in right. you, but I don't see in a lot of places. What would you say for someone who's kind of trapped in an unhealthy organization where they're trying to develop as a leader, but the leader may be over them or next to them, doesn't have that kind of healthy, transparency, security, and humility mm-hmm. that you're talking about?
You said at the beginning that everything rises and falls on leadership. I don't have much hope for that person who's buried in an organization where the senior leadership is not demonstrating the qualities we just talked about. Mm-hmm. So I would like to say that there's some way that they can change that. It may not happen. What they can do is make sure the people who they work with in the area for which they are responsible have modeled for them the right kind of leadership.
Wow.
And so, that speaks volumes about the responsibility of people on the board or others who select senior leadership to make sure that you get people who are not only have the capacity to do a job, but have the character to sustain them in the success they're going to achieve. One of the sad things I see in Christian leadership is that oftentimes expertise causes us to have success that our character cannot sustain. And so as we rise in influence, we develop pride, we develop a self-focus, we develop a sense that the organization exists to serve us. And those things have to be, those are character issues, not leadership issues. Mm. They have to be resolved. They have to stay in step. As a person is expanding in leadership, the character has to be expanding as well.
Mm-hmm. I've often said that those with great ability, that their ability often outpaces their character and ability mm-hmm. to handle their own ability.
Right.
And so we're seeing this, we're talking about this. You know, I wrote that series on unhealthy Christian organizations. I got complaints from people in three different organizations saying I was talking about them.
Yes.
And I was like, really? I'm writing general ideas, but somebody with greater wisdom than I said, listen, if you throw a rock into a pack of dogs, the one that got whelped is the one that got hit. The one that whelps is the one that got hit.
Right.
And so there's a real issue here. And your exhortation actually is kind of similar to my exhortation. I said, you can try to change, but probably it's going to change you more than you can change the organization.
Right. And the one thing I would say to senior leaders is that it's extremely important in senior leadership that you have a very clear-cut supervisory and evaluation and accountability process. You know, as a president of a seminary, I have a board that I'm responsible to, but beyond that, the board has a smaller number of members who are directly responsible to supervise me. And I don't mean they supervise me on a day-to-day
right.
function, but what they do is a couple of times a year they sit down with me and they talk with the people who work with me, they evaluate what they see, and they sit down with me and say, here are some issues you might that we want you to think about. Issues of overcommitment,
right.
issues of accessibility, and these are... these are, in our case, so far at least, areas that they want me to make correction, not areas where I'm in crisis.
Right, right.
And so what happens is if you make incremental correction with good supervision, even a senior leader needs that in order to maintain the kind of transparency, humility, and honesty we're talking about.
Okay, but what a pastor, you know, in many denominations, depending on the denomination, you might have a vestry, or you might have a mm-hmm. session, or you might have elders or deacons, but typically the pastor's the leader, and often, particularly in growing churches or churches that are marked by we're going to move forward and we're going to charge hell with a water pistol together, they actually tend to be very unaccountable. So how would you say to a pastor, pastors and leaders watching now, to create some of these accountable systems that may not be within their polity or their structure?
That is exactly what has to happen. The pastor has to take the initiative to create the structure. Mm-hmm. Most churches value highly the pastoral office,
right.
respect most pastors. Sure, there are some that make news that don't do well, but
right.
the vast majority of pastors are good, hardworking,
yeah.
faithful people that their church members look up to
yep.
and respect. So unless the pastor takes the initiative, the only time he will receive supervision or be held accountable is when there's a crisis.
Right.
And that's the worst possible time to create a structure
mm-hmm.
to help a person grow in leadership or in character. And so the best time is when things are going well is to look at the kind of church government you're functioning with and the kind of denominational structures you have and to say, how can I set up a group within that structure that can give me feedback on a periodic basis mm-hmm. about the kind of job I'm doing. And also, the congregation can know is working with me to make me a better pastor.
Mm.
I realize there are all kinds of reasons why people avoid this because they've got war stories of this
sure,
abuse,
sure.
but the reality is most of us function a lot better when we have that kind of responsive accountability
Agree.
To someone.
Agree. I heard someone say there's church governance where they had functional elders, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they were like a team of a plurality of elders and equals, and it said something very profound. I don't remember who it was, but they said if your elders never tell you no, you don't have elders.
Right.
They're basically just people who say yes to the pastor constantly, and so if there's no one who can say to you, and I got to tell you, I can think of thousands of examples where pastors, mm-hmm. network leaders, denomination leaders, where nobody can come to them at all. In some cases, you can't get through layers of people who are saying yes to the leader and say, no, this is a bad idea.
Yeah.
And I think it's, and I love the fact that you're calling us to some other approach to leadership and you yourself modeling that great leadership. When we're going to come back, we're going to talk more about that. I'm going to jump in. I'm going to talk a little bit about your chaplaincy role with the Giants there in San Francisco. So let's take a break. We'll be back in just a few minutes and we'll continue our conversation with Jeff Orge.
If you talk about chaplaincy.
Words can't unleash
the very creative nature that God has put in every individual. And it is a huge responsibility to pay attention to words, because words do matter. At B&H Publishing, we're 100 people. We're a small team. And because of that, we're fully a team. So we bring the strength of every competency, every experience, all the talent that comes around shaping content. Because we're small, we're agile. We can speak into all the process. We can come around an author and a message together. Last year alone, there were over 1 million books published. A lot of noise. But at B&H, we want to take that noise, and we want to be intentional and purposeful in the content that we produce. We don't want to do 1 million books. We want to do a few books. A few books on purpose, that we have a vision that that content will give people hope and encouragement, transform their lives, help them to be all that God has created them to be. The barriers are down. The opportunity's here. We want to be innovative in how we think about that. We really have a vision for reaching the entire world. And it is exciting. It is challenging. I mean, words, the ability to take those to all parts of the culture where people live has never been greater. Every word matters, because words have the power to build up or to tear down. Words have the power to encourage or to discourage, to give hope and life or to bring death.
God has a great story to tell.
God has a great story to tell.
And He's telling it through people.
Through the lives of people every day.
Every word matters.
Every word matters.
Every word matters.
Every word matters.
At B&H, every word matters.
And we are back with Jeff Orjan. Good to see you, Jeff. Appreciate you being here. Hopefully we're encouraging pastors and church leaders, provoking them to love and good deeds. We are active in the chat room. If you're watching this during the broadcast, if you're watching on Vimeo later, obviously not, but you can join in with us there along the way. Jeff, you are the chaplain of the Giants, which I believe is a baseball franchise.
Exactly.
Score. And you are also an umpire, not a referee, in baseball as well. And this is fascinating to me, and not really the topic of our discussion today, but just since it's so fascinating, tell us a little about what it's like to be the chaplain of a professional baseball team.
Well, first of all, the reason I do it is pretty important to me, and that is I believe that my responsibility to fulfill the Great Commission cannot be administrated through other people. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a component of my life
as a
leader.
That's so good. That's so good. It's so convicting. Your responsibility to fill the Great Commission cannot be administrated through other people.
Right.
A lot of pastors and leaders would say, well, I got people doing that for me.
Yeah. Well, I don't.
Okay. Nice.
I think that I'm responsible to be a model for the students and faculty at Golden Gate Seminary of a person who's engaging lost people, winning them to faith in Christ, and discipling them to live the faith.
Okay, yeah, you are the president of one of the 15 largest seminaries in the United States.
Yeah.
Doing all these things, and yet, I think that's a key issue. You can't lead what you do not live,
right,
and you're seeking to model it out. So I interrupted you, so tell us more about the Giants.
No, that's what I do. It's corporate chaplaincy. Mm-hmm. It just happens to be with a baseball team. I work with players and their families. I have a Spanish language partner who helps me with this responsibility. My wife works with the women. We're in the clubhouse about 15 weekends a year. We also lead Bible studies, crisis counseling, all the things pastors do. The baseball community is a very insulated community because they play every day.
Right.
And the travel schedule, the family schedule, the demands on them are very significant. And so we try to intersect that and take the gospel there.
Wow.
And it's a very fulfilling responsibility on what happens with them, but it's also, I think, very important responsibility to be a model of a person who's actually doing what we try to teach other people how to do as pastors.
I thought when you became a professor or a pastor, you didn't do anymore. You just taught others to do.
Well, that's what some do. Yeah. But I frankly cannot understand how you can have any integrity about what you teach if you're not practicing it on a regular basis. And my background's church planting. My academic training was in evangelism. I just feel strongly that I have to be modeling this. And so it's not that I do that for the most of my time. The vast majority of my time is spent being a seminary president.
Yeah. Yeah.
But some of my time has to be spent really focused on fulfilling the mission that God has given us. And so I hear pastors and other leaders talk about delegating away all responsibility. personally for these kinds of issues, but I just don't think you can do that. I think there has to be a slice of your life that is personally accountable to fulfilling the things that we preach and teach and challenge other people to do all the time.
It's not just motivating other people, it's modeling in our own lives what to do. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk some about that issue. And let me just say, too, before we jump into the next question, that one of the reasons I love Golden Gate and highly recommend Golden Gate to others is because of that culture you have created there. Just such a strong missional focus, a passion to reach. And throughout the West, Golden Gate is not just in Mill Valley, which is San Francisco, but it's in Colorado. And well, give me the place. Where are the campuses?
We have five campuses in the Los Angeles and San Francisco areas, and then Denver, Portland, Oregon, and Phoenix, Arizona.
And just doing a great job, and appreciate so much the work that you're doing. Talk to me a little bit about leadership and this new book that you have. And we have a picture of it here on the screen. People can get a copy of it. But it's Seasons of a Leader's Life. It's Seasons of a Leader's Life. And the subtitle is Learning, Leading, and Leaving Your Legacy. In the book, you use Peter as an example of leadership. And in what ways do you see leaders in Scripture kind of exhibit different styles of leadership? Because you talk about some of these styles and seasons. Tell us about them, and then tell us how Peter relates.
Right. Well, I wrote the book because I used to be a young leader, and now I'm finding out I'm not one anymore.
Oh, that's hard.
The definition of when you're not a young leader is when you're hiring people to work with you that are the age of your children.
Oh, wow.
And so I reached the point where I'm at the front edge of legacy leaving. Yeah. I've been a learner, I've been a leader, and I still am a leader, but I'm starting to think about what legacy of leadership will I leave? And so that's what motivated me to think about the book. And why I chose Peter. Peter's a unique biblical character in that he is described in quite a bit of detail as a learner in the Gospels, the leader in the book of Acts, and then he wrote a legacy in his two letters, 1 and 2 Peter. Hmm. And so the book is divided into those three sections, learner, leader, legacy. And what I did was identified every story in which Peter is singled out by name. And for example, in the feeding of the 5,000, the disciples were present, but Peter's not named. So I omitted that story. Right. But in every story where he's named specifically, I categorized those and wrote about from the perspective of leadership. So in the Gospels, I asked the question, in this story, what was Peter learning?
Right.
And in the Acts, not a commentary, not that kind of book, but instead I asked the question, what was he doing as a leader?
Right.
And then in the last, what was he writing as a legacy to say, this is stuff I don't want you to ever forget?
Yeah.
And so the book just flows through those three seasons of his life, looking at every story. It's not really a devotional book, but the chapters are short, and it could be used for training staff or working with people in a congregational setting to raise up leaders. It could be, as we talked earlier, about that group of people that you can meet with. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of resource you could read each week and talk through. So I tried to write from a biblical perspective about those three phases. And another reason I chose to do it this way is there's a lot of books written on leadership, a lot of books. And frankly, there aren't enough books written about leadership really from a biblical perspective. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean biblical in the sense that it has some biblical truth interwoven in it. I mean actually looking at text of Scripture and saying, what were these people doing that really were significant leaders? And what can we learn from that? So that's kind of the progression that I used. And so I'm fairly excited about just looking at life from that vantage point. Now it's causing me to look at Peter's legacy and say, okay, he wrote a legacy that he left for all time. I'll never do anything that rises to even close to that kind of level, but what can I leave that's really going to make a difference maybe a little while after I'm gone?
I like that. And one of the reasons I love your writing on leadership, you talk again about, we mentioned earlier about transparency, about security, about humility, those three characteristics. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned that when I see leadership books or leadership experts who lack those three things, because I think when you kind of begin without those things and you kind of encourage people towards being a leader, but there's not an evidence of that in your writing or even in your life, the end result is you actually create leadership from a culture that's warped. And so when you're in a healthy culture, in a healthy environment with a healthy leader, I know it seems a little weird, I'm like saying that you're a healthy leader, but we're sitting right here. But I would say that outside of your presence, to me, that's the kind of encouragement, I think, why this book is so helpful. And it's not really a book, it's not a book about Peter, it's a book about leaders.
It's a book about leaders.
With Peter kind of as the example, where you hang some hooks on along the way.
Right. And it's a book about the things leaders need to learn that are foundational to the kind of person we're talking about here. One of the things that really impacted me in making the study is that some of the things I've put a lot of emphasis on teaching young leaders, I didn't really find in Peter's lessons. Hmm. And then there's some lessons that he learned that as I look back, I think, yeah, that is foundational to what I do every day, but no one ever really sat down and said that's a fundamental leadership lesson.
Right.
For example, once Peter came and said, Jesus, they want me to pay a tax. Do I have to pay a tax? Mm-hmm. And Jesus said, yeah, we're going to pay that tax, and here's what you do. Go down to the lake and toss in a hook and bring up one fish. Now, Peter was a fisherman who fished with a net. He was
right.
a commercial fisherman.
Right.
So he says, one net, one hook, one fish. He brings it out, and what's in the fish? One coin.
Sure.
Pay the tax. And I thought about, what was Jesus trying to teach him that day? It wasn't about we pay tax. That's not the point.
Right.
It wasn't about you go fish with a hook. You know, what's the deal? And well, the deal is, whatever the need, I can provide.
Mm-hmm.
And I can provide in unusual ways. Now, I'm a senior leader of an organization that has significant need. In fact, every step of the way that I've moved along in my life, I've had to lead organizations that had to have money and resources and people. And I'm constantly praying for and asking God to provide. And it's been a growing process of me learning how to trust God to do that. And so I realized that really one of the fundamental lessons that a young leader has to learn, God will provide. And we talk at seminary, for example, students come in and say, you know, I didn't have the money for the semester, and then I prayed and I worked, and then this envelope came, and they're elated at what God has done. And now I'm learning from writing the book and studying Peter that actually that's one of the fundamental lessons that seminary should be teaching people, and that is we're going to put you in a situation where you don't have enough, and you have to find God's provision. We're not going to give it to you. And so I've realized, you know, that some of this co-curricular stuff that we talk about in the prayer meeting, on campus is really what they're there to learn is that kind of thing.
Good.
So that's some of the ways the book shaped me and what I was trying to get at when I wrote it.
I love it. Again, the book is Seasons of a Leader's Life, Learning, Leading, and Leaving Your Legacy. Jeff Orge. And Jeff, tell me a little bit about desiring leadership roles and the struggle with issues of ambition, and how does that not become pride, or how is it not presumptuous?
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us a little bit about, how should we think of this desire to be a leader?
I think that you should desire to be a leader, and there's nothing inappropriate about it. Paul wrote and said, if you aspire to be an overseer or a pastor, that is a good thing.
Right.
Aspire, have ambition for, long for, want to be. Now, most denominational groups and even independent churches have a check and balance to this that is really is a beautiful thing. And that is, you may say that God has called you to be a pastor and you may want to be a pastor, but if no church or denominational group ever asks you to be one,
right.
you're not going to get it.
Sure.
And so I don't think there's anything wrong with aspiring to leadership roles, because in the kingdom of God, as expressed in most every church I know about and in most denominations, there's a balance where some individual or some group has to say, we actually want you to be our pastor or our youth pastor or our missionary. And until you're selected, your call is not really finalized.
Right.
So I'd like to challenge, especially younger people, be passionate, go after it. Let the check and balance be that people will confirm or deny the reality of your call. And don't just sit back saying, I'm not worthy, or some kind of other false humility statement that really excuses you in disobedience from what God is trying to get you to do. I think about John the Baptist. When when they came to John and said, who are you? He didn't scuff his toe and say, I'm nobody. He said, well, I'm the one who's making the way for one who's coming after me.
Right.
I have a role. I know what that role is. I'm not the top guy, but I am important to the process. And so it's okay to own who you are, to own the responsibility God has given you, and to want to fulfill that and to be happy about that. There's a check and balance that'll keep you in place. Now, once you become a leader, the temptation is then to, as I said earlier, cast off that accountability structure that called you in the first place and then explode in pride and other things. You want to get away from that. But I'd say, in answer to your first question or your primary question, go after it.
Yeah.
Go after
really?
It.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So leadership, aspiring to leadership is a good thing.
I think it's a great thing.
First Timothy 3 is talking about, of course, the qualifications and the role of a pastor elder. But I mean, I think the principle is there. There's a lot of other ways to aspire as well.
Absolutely.
Now, you're talking about raising up new leaders. You've talked a lot about younger leaders. I was with Troy Gramling. He's a pastor of a Potential Church down in Florida. It used to be Flamingo Road. And he was doing an interview. This was a few years ago. And he said to me, Ed, what are you doing to raise up the next generation of leaders? And I don't know, I was probably 40 at the time, so a few years ago. And it was interesting because we're the same age and we've become friends. I've had the privilege of preaching in his church. But I was kind of like, I answered the question, but internally I was thinking, well, wait a second. the next, I'm the next generation
right,
of
right,
leaders.
Right, right.
So, because, you know, I was 40 at the time. In our denomination, you're a young leader till your mid-50s. And so what does it look like to make that transition? I mean, to me, and now I've kind of moved through, I no longer consider myself a young leader. In fact, I hired a guy recently, Micah Fries, and he once tweeted that I wasn't as young as I thought I was and kind of hurt my feelings
right,
so I, when I had
right,
hired him.
Right.
And he's a little younger, that he's not as young as he thinks he is. So how do you make that transition from the learning stage to the leading stage, mm-hmm. and then begin to start thinking about the legacy when sometimes we don't want to let go of that? How do you do that?
Well, actually, first of all, these phases really sort of overlap each other.
Okay.
Because I hope you're still a learner.
Yep.
I think you are.
Hope so.
And so you're a learner, but in the early part of life, your primary focus is learning. And then you move into leading, and you still keep learning, but now your primary focus is leading. And even in that early phase when you were the primary learner, you were testing by leading a few things.
Right.
So there's overlap to all of this. But I think there's a progression of time where, or a progression of responsibility where you really one day wake up and realize I'm still learning, but right now, you know, I'm a leader. Mm-hmm. When I was elected to lead a denominational group, I met with one of the senior guys that had been there a while, and I said, I'd come out of the pastorate, and I said to him, man, I'm being asked to preach so many places and so many times, and I just don't really know how I have to time. Where will I find the time to study?
Right.
And he looked at me, or I said, find the time to study and prepare.
Right.
And he looked at me and said, if you were placed in this job, you're already prepared.
Hmm.
Preach who you are and what you know.
Hmm.
Well, that was a big moment for
me
because up until that point in my life, I had focused so long on being a pastor and
right,
studied so much for every Sunday. And now I realized I'm in a new phase of life
right,
where the people now want to know out of the reservoir of who I am and what I've proven, what I have. And yeah, I better keep learning, but I better use a lot of the learning I already have. Now, as you move into the legacy phase, the temptation is to think, well, I've learned everything. Well, you haven't. You've got to keep learning.
That's good.
But you've got to recognize that it's time for other people to start taking the primary leadership role, and you're going to move into more of a coaching role, an advising role, and an encouraging role.
Sure.
And so one of the problems at the legacy level is simply holding on too long.
Yeah.
And I met with a guy recently who was lamenting that no one would be able to take over his organization.
Wow.
And he gave me all the reasons why, and then he told me that he was 80.
Wow.
And I thought, well, what if you had decided 20 years ago to have someone in place by 70 and to just be their coach and advisor till you were 80 and let them lead? Where would things be different? But because he had convinced himself no one could take over, he's not going to leave a legacy.
Wow.
He's going to leave a dying organization instead of a living one.
And there's no success without that successor.
That's right.
You know,
that is exactly right. That's exactly right.
I wrote a blog post on called basically about leaders who don't finish well, because I was out in a conversation with a key leader in an evangelical denomination, and we were just talking about the leadership and the transition, and had a leader who wasn't finishing well, who was kind of undercutting those who would succeed, actually had gone through a series of dissatisfied successors, and we started saying, you know, this is not an uncommon situation.
Right.
We said, and we national thing, it wouldn't help to necessarily lame them, but we were like, this national leader, this national leader, this national leader, this national leader, over and over again in multiple denominations. And I was struck by that, and I was grieved by that. And so I wrote this because I see maybe even some of that in myself too. I need to finish well, because part of finishing well is the journey. The journey doesn't end rightly if you haven't finished well. And so what exhortation would you say to maybe an older pastor who's now saying, well, how do I finish well on this journey?
Well, I think first of all, remember what it was like when you were 25 and some older guys gave you an opportunity and encouraged you and actually promoted you into the responsibility that you ultimately had.
Mm.
Remember how that felt and what they did for you, and make a commitment to doing that for other people. One of the things that I really admire about one particular leader is that he actually left a little early as far as the organization was concerned, but he was determined not to stay too long, and if he was going to err on the too early side. And when he did that, I actually followed him into the responsibility, and he became my behind-the-scenes supporter, ambassador, promoter, and a lot of my success was due to what he did behind the scenes to facilitate that. I want to be that kind of person. I want to be able to stand back and say, what I built is going on, and I can trust another person to carry it on. And I want to do for young guys what a guy did for me when I was in that phase. The other thing I remember when I was a younger leader in my 20s is I remember being so zealous for the kinds of changes that I knew had to come in the church and had to come in our work if it was going to go forward. And so I was a church planter, and I planted a new church that was quite different than the other churches in our denomination in that area. And the people that were the most supportive of me were actually the oldest guys. Mm. It was the middle guys, the middle-aged guys that were threatened by what I was doing. But the older guys said, no, this is the future, and this is what we've got to support. And now I look at younger guys that are doing things in churches, and I scratch my head and think, what are they doing? And I realize that's what people thought of me, and I don't want to be that guy. Awesome. I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, sure.
I remember one older couple. He was actually a layman, but a very long-time Christian leader. He and his wife, they were in their 70s. And when we planted our new church, they said, we'd like to be a part of your church. Is there a place for us? And I said, well, there's certainly a place for you, but you have to remember what kind of, or have to realize what kind of church we're going to be. And they said, yeah, we know what kind of church you're going to be. We want to be a part of it. And he looked at me and said, because you're the future. And we want to be a part of that. When I'm that age,
right,
I want to be saying that to guys
that's
in their
awesome.
20s. You're that's the awesome. Future, and I want to be part of that.
That's awesome.
So that's I think, some of the things that are required to get there.
That's a good word. Tell me a little bit about why you think that sometimes organizations that have a high focus on doctrinal strength, doctrinal fidelity, particularly now as that pendulum swings back and forth, and now that we're sort of in a, in my view, we're sort of in an anti-leadership culture in many of the doctrinally driven churches and denominations, and that concerns me. I think they need to pick up some leadership books. I think it would be valuable for them to pick up your books or a Maxwell book or whatever. But why is it that the doctrinal driven folks sometimes have the hardest time thinking through issues of leadership?
Well, it's because they have two misconceptions. The first one is that they live in an either-or world, and I live in a both-and world.
Yeah.
I think it's possible to hold to doctrinal integrity, which our seminary does, and at the same time to hold on to the reality of training people to lead, and that those things really can go together. So it doesn't have to be one or the other. It's a both-and process. The second misunderstanding that some leaders have is that if you preach and teach an accurate word from God, all other problems will immediately be solved. And they simply aren't.
That's
you
right.
simply have to know how to work with people.
It's a crazy
idea. Help people to know how to assimilate, understand, and apply, if you will, the truth they're being taught. So I don't advocate one inch of backup from doctrinal integrity. I think it's absolutely essential. And the more than half of our Master's of Divinity curriculum is Bible, theology, biblical languages, history. We believe in that.
Yeah.
But the companion to that is learning, you know, really how to work with people to win them to faith in Christ, nurture them in their discipleship, move them into leadership development, and then yourself knowing how to do those things so you can teach other people how to do those things. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be both, and they have to learn how to work together.
Amen. One more question. You've talked a lot about churches and the churches as they develop leaders. Does the average church do a good job with that, developing leaders on a local level?
Probably not.
Okay.
The average pastor is spending time looking for leaders, and when one emerges, trying to find a way to put that person to work.
Okay.
But in terms of looking at someone and saying, I want to move this person forward in their leadership capacity, I don't see a lot of intentionality about that. But when I teach on it, I see a lot of pastors' eyes light up with the possibilities of what that can be.
And what do you tell them? How would you tell them to do that, to be more intentional? Because people be watching, you know, they've got it's an hour show, and they've kind of tuned in. They're like, okay, what do I do? So kind of close us
with that. Well, I talked about having a leadership development group.
Kind of a community of leadership development.
And that goes on every year in some form. Does it have to be a large group, 3, 5, 7, 10 guys?
Yeah.
And it can be, and because you're doing it in a group, it can be, you know, men, women together, it's fine. But then you find those one or two guys that you're going to pour into individually, and you say, well, what about the women? You need to find some women that you can raise up to that level of leadership who can start doing that for you as well. But here's the thing I want to challenge pastors to do, and that is stop. If you rated everyone in your church on a leadership scale of 1 to 10, I'm not suggesting you actually do this, and please don't post the information anywhere.
Put it on your blog.
But let's just say that you had a leadership scale. 1 is not much, 10 is superstar.
Yeah.
Stop looking for the 10s. Look for the 2s, and don't say, I'm going to turn the 2 into a 10. You're not.
Right.
Turn the 2 into a 4.
That's good.
I say, well, I want to turn a 4 into a 7. Maybe. You might be able to do that. Do it if you can. Look at the levels of leadership required in your congregation and in your ministry, and look for the people that you can move up and into those roles, and recognize not everyone's going to be elder material, but you can train people to work in other levels of leadership and management processes in your church, and have that kind of vision. I'm going to raise everyone's capacity, and when God does give you an 8 or a 9 guy or an 8 or a 9 woman that you can turn into a 10, pour your life into that person. No questions asked about the importance of that. But don't just rivet on that only. You've got to raise people at all levels to staff and lead a multifaceted growing ministry.
Awesome. The book is Seasons of a Leader's Life. It's now available. People can pick it up. You can find more information about Jeff at jefforg.com, is it, or .org?
.com.
.com. And I encourage you to do so. There's a lot of helpful resources there. And Jeff, thank you for not just coming on the exchange today, but thank you for being a role model to a lot of us.
Thank
you very much. We appreciate you and appreciate what you're doing
at
Golden Gate. So thanks for joining us on this week's edition of The Exchange. We'll continue. We'll be live next week. We'll continue our conversations with ministry leaders, church leaders, so we can provoke one another to love and good deed. Our hope this has been an encouraging time to you. You can find this book, Seasons of a Leader's Life, at any Christian bookstore. I want to encourage you, particularly go to lifeway.com. You can pick up the resource there as well. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you next week.